This is Level With Her, a podcast of in-depth conversations with video game greats. And this is part two of my in-depth discussion with Quest for Glory co-creator, Lori Cole. Now, even with this sort of universal likability principle, you made your scenarios, and I guess this is what you said about stories need a place to grow. Every time you made a new game, you started all over. Some characters crossed over, but a lot of them were very different settings. I mean, with Quest for Glory, it was like, you know, middle Dark Ages Persia, the African savannah, Eastern Europe, Transylvania style. Your games had a level of diversity back then that people seem to believe now has to be forced into games. But you were doing it all on your own with no prompting. What caused you to want to bring in fictionalized versions of other cultures into your games?
Well, I was always thinking of the game thing as a one long story anyway, It's, you know, from the beginning to the end, but I was dragging the player on these great adventures too. So it was like, you know, the campaign of D&D, you know, that there was a massive story that was out there and the player was going from the different locations throughout to complete the entire story. And I really wanted to, you know, we started out in a Germanic, European story, fairy tale setting, so that people were familiar with that. They knew what they were getting into when they started. But then we were going to the wild places that, you know, were whole different mythos and things, because I really wanted to show the player that there was more to the world than just, you know, the mythos of European settlements and things like that, so that I wanted to give the player this sense that the world is amazing and a marvelous place, whether it's Earth or Gloriana.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it was still very approachable. I mean, with Quest for Glory 2, it's, you know, it's 101 nights, essentially. You were borrowing from that canon, but then you had, you know, Groucho Marx involved in that setting. Was that kind of an organic thing of, wouldn't this be funny? Or was there was a deliberateness from that classic culture and pop culture fusion?
Well, it can't, you know, when we started having in the game from the first, it was going to be a very serious, you know, dramatic D&D style game with what was going on. But because we had artists that were more cartoony in style, and we had a programmer who had a great sense of humor and started putting in, and an artist who, you know, basically put in these little minor jokes and things like that, like the Three Stooges into the first game, that we said, this is what we have to work with. Let us make that our strengths.
Now, so, you said we there. How
it is a team.
How do you work with your husband for 30 years?
Oh, that isn't easy. And when I said we, I didn't mean just
the
Corey.
Team. Yeah.
I meant the team. The real best games that we ever did came from the synergy of the team.
Now, this is so different from some of these, like, I call them auteur game designers, who they have their vision and they will scream and yell and throw things to get that vision. And I don't necessarily believe that creates a better product, because then, you know, eventually the best advice I was given on game design is, eventually you have to just make the best game you can with what you have. And it sounds like you come into that from the very beginning, basically saying that, you know, okay, I've got this component and this component and this component and this component. I'm going to use this, not fight that. Is that experience, or is that just sort of your personality there?
Well, it's also, well, it really comes down to, I mean, we were amateurs. We didn't know what we were doing. We didn't know what was right or wrong because at that time there were no right and wrong. There were no rules to be written. We had to make things up as we went along. And one thing I'm very good at in a D&D style game is improvisation and going from where we are. So I have a team. I know what the strengths of I will figure out and find out what the strengths of the team are, and I will use them to make the game better. And that's what I've always gone with when, you know, from the beginning. And Sierra's accommodated it at times, and at other times they have, you know, totally kept it from being able to do that sort of thing, like when they started segregating the teams and having all the game design supposed to be done up front. And all of those things work against trying to make a cohesive, you know, brilliant game.
What do you mean all the game design up front? You had to present the complete story, no iterations allowed?
Right. They wanted that. They wanted the story up front and everything designed out. And they thought that's how you make a game at that point in time.
The modern game designers are laughing at that.
It didn't work.
Yeah,
it
doesn't
was very
work.
Clear. And nobody actually succeeded in doing that. But other than that, it was a nice theory that was totally wrong.
Yeah, I don't think any art, I mean, even films have reshoots, you know, even books have editing. That is that, again, just sort of business people who didn't I mean, Sierra was, everybody was sort of developer there, right? There were no like accountants calling the shots back then, or were there?
There were not, but then everybody, well, they kept trying to have accountants calling the shots. They kept trying because you cannot, I mean, you cannot actually manage a computer game. There is no way. It grows as it grows depending upon its team members, and the game takes, you know, as long as you can. You know, you're fighting the company who wants to ship it immediately.
Right.
But it may or may not be done, you know.
Now, the business seems to have come to your way of thinking more and more. Instead of shipping a broken game, there's more tolerance for, you know, delaying a game 3 months, 6 months. If it's a Naughty Dog game, 9 months. Do you think that's a maturing of the industry as a whole, or do you think that's designers having more control over the process?
I think it's the bottom dollar. The fact that people totally stopped playing certain games because they were too buggy.
So you really think it was consumer market forces that people just voted with their wallets? That's really interesting, because that's a big debate right now, whether that works or not.
Well, the people that run companies have to worship the dollar more than anybody else. Mm-hmm. And so therefore money really does talk to them, because that's what they're in it for. They're not in it for the art, they're in it for the money. And if that money isn't coming in because they screwed up and released the game too soon, and suddenly they get all this terrible bad press, but worse, they didn't sell the game,
right,
then they will listen to that.
Now, do you think making a game is a different challenge than making a movie in that regard? Because there are so many movies, like I always joke, if you want to make a movie that makes $1 billion, make sure it's mediocre. Like everybody goes in and that was okay, but no, very few people really love the movie. Video games are so different for me. Like if people don't love a game, it sucks. It's all or nothing with games. Have you found that?
Well, that's pretty much the attitude out there with everything in the world, you know, with when you're on the internet.
Okay.
It's love it, hate it, you know, there is no in between, because the people that are on the internet and who are talking are the ones that are passionate about something. And nobody writes about something that's mediocre because it isn't interesting enough to write about.
So you're saying that the internet is fostering a culture of extremes?
It is. And, you know, you have the people that write things for the internet, and you have the people that absorb what they wrote for the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore, we have this large passive group out there that just want to be entertained, you know?
Right.
And right. So therefore, they need to be entertained. If something is about something dull, it's not interesting enough to read. So therefore, the pool won't look at it. And so therefore, it rewards behavior that is extreme.
Now, that's got to be a real challenge in making games today, because obviously, you know, back when you started, we had the internet, but you put a phone in a cradle and it made like beepy noises at you. It wasn't like it is today. You've had to adapt to this environment. What kind of changes have you seen over the years?
Well, we did not have, you know, the ability to see our fans right there up close and personal, or even know who they were, except with letters that would come infrequently. Mm-hmm. And I had correspondence with some of our fans, but that was like months and months between letters at that point. There was nothing, you know, immediate or reinforcing because of it. And now we're into this whole, everything's a game now, really, in life, because mm-hmm. you're getting immediate reinforcement from looking on the internet, you know.
And do you enjoy that interaction?
Yes, I do. I really do. This is, you know, it's what keeps us going. When we were doing Quest for Glory, and it was taking so many years between games, mm-hmm. and we didn't even know if we'd get to finish it, and then we knew we weren't going to be able to finish it, and all that. What kept us and kept me trying to do it was the idea that there were some people who were affected by my games who felt like these were worth playing. And so all along, the thing that kept me trying to fight to keep making these games were the idea that somebody really appreciated it and it was meaningful to them.
So are you just starting to get a sense of the impact that your games had on people?
Well, even when we were doing games for Sierra Online, you'd get the unusual letter from somebody that, you know, like from behind the Iron Curtain, which, you know, at that point was the Eastern European bloc, who were controlled by Russia and the USSR. They had no access to our games legally. Everything over there was, you know, against the law to have, our games. You could not sell to that area. Mm-hmm. But there were people back there who played our games and who wrote me a letter. You know, a couple people wrote me a letter of how they're living this in this situation of total depression where everything's, you know, a struggle from day to day, but the games gave them life and made them feel like there was something more to the world and living than just this gray day to day trying to fight for existence type thing. Wow. And so I knew that our games actually could affect people's sense of self.
Now, this is a really touchy-feely question, purely emotional. I hate usually asking questions like this, but I gotta know this one. What's the journey like for you as a professional and as a person to start wanting to make this super serious, epic, good versus evil fantasy? Falling into this really whimsical kind of pop culture pastiche that still had its moments of gripping drama, but was much lighter than what you'd originally intended. And then finding out how much that meant to people.
Well, it was quite a journey because the first time I started to see the art coming up for our game and what the artists were doing. And it's like, wait a second, this is not where we wanted to go. It just isn't going to work. Nothing's
it's so
working.
Pink. Yeah.
It's like so frustrating. Yeah. You know, I have only myself to blame for that first scene, because I did do a drawing of it initially. And I did use those colors because I was using colored pencil to do it. And because I knew there were limited palettes, so I was using a limited pencil. And what do you know? My artist gave me something that looked exactly like what I had drawn. And it's like, no, I really wanted something that was artistic, not that. But, you know, it's, you got to work with what you've got, or else you're just hitting your head against the wall. And you don't have, you know, you don't have the ability to change people's art. You can only direct them to do the way you you know, to use their own strengths, or else you get a mess.
See, that is so different than talking to other game developers, because I have this vision and people must, you know, follow my vision because it's the vision, and they throw things and they yell and they scream and they fire people and they burn people out and they make people do things over and over and over again. How do you find the line? How do you balance maintaining a certain amount of quality control and yet letting everybody feel included and it really being a team effort and everybody seeing something of their ideas in the final product?
Well, it isn't easy, because you have to design anything, you have to have a vision. You know, you have to have the way you think it should look and what it should do. And then you get your art or whatever that you're working with, and then you have to say, is this good enough? Will this work? And sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes you see something that the artist is in love with, and you see it and say, this just doesn't work. And you got to find a way to actually say that, because you have to be true to your vision in the end, because you really do have to control the situation. It isn't a random, everybody gets to contribute to the creating the game. No, because you get hodgepodge messes when you do that. So there does have to be somebody in charge who says, does this work or does it not? And have a way to make the people that are contributing feel like they still are contributing, and they aren't just, you know, a person that's, you know, hired in the background to do something and who has no power either. Because people who feel like they have a say and have power in creating the game are the ones that give you the magic.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like you sort of intuitively have that good management is as much about saying yes as saying no principle going on here.
Well, it's purely random, because after all, I had no background in business or management or anything. And when we went to, you know, when I went to Sierra Online, the first thing they said is, oh yeah, the game designer's in charge of a team. Okay. What? I'm an introvert by nature. You're going to put me in charge when I have no business experience whatsoever and no team management experience? But that's the way Sierra was at the time. They had no business management themselves.
But so, you were a teacher before.
I was. But the teachers are different. Teachers are in charge. Teachers set the rules. Teachers do everything top down. And a team is not a class of students passively sitting in chairs. You know, the team is going to create your project. So you cannot be the authoritarian manager and really, you know, expect magic.
So did you pick up all of this while you were working?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, it was on the spot improv.
So you were running a D&D campaign the entire time you were making games?
A lot, yes. Every time it's a new game. Yes, new team, new players, new skills. Got to find a way to make use of them the best that you can.
Well, you've just confirmed my idea that we could write a management book using Dungeons and Dragons.
Oh, I think so. I really believe in it, because absolutely, that is a great place to start for any business person if you really want to make a great product.
Now, you're a big proponent in general of the positive impacts of games. You're not one of these people who comes from an educational background who are afraid of video games. What do you
obviously
think, yeah, what do you think people why do you think people get scared by video games? They immediately just, it's that emotional response first, and then they cherry pick facts to back up that emotional response. It's not logical.
Well, the people that are reacting like that haven't played games, and those people are fewer and fewer and fewer, because we are surrounded by games now. Mm-hmm. Everybody plays games, even the 95-year-old grandmothers who never picked up a game are playing something on their cell phones, for God's sake. Mm-hmm. So everybody plays games now, and there'll be less and less of that fear of a game. But I'll tell you, when years ago when we were doing a the computer game developers conferences, there was a round table on the effect of militarization and the fact that the military were using games to teach soldiers and that.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was serious debate on whether we were, you know, dehumanizing people with some of these war games that there were out there and that. And it is a real concern. I mean, but it just depends upon the game.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah, it's
whether
not
you make, yeah.
Yeah, it's not inherent yeah. to games. It's what the game does.
Yes. And so, yes, a game that rewards you for killing Nazis is kind of conditioning you in a way that, it's okay to shoot people, you know, it's desensitizing you to the concept. And there were serious studies about how in the early wars, people were presented with an enemy, they couldn't shoot them.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was only after many, many training in the army that they learned to shoot first and not think of them as human.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So all of these are really serious conversations that need to be addressed. But I did my best to not have to address them because I did not make generic people to be, you know, just to be killed.
No, well, they were brigands. They were more heavily armed. They were coming at you. They were clearly aggressors. They were bullies.
Yes, right. And so, therefore, I tried to, and even with my bad guys, I tried to, you know, give the player the chance to not think of them as just targets. They were real. I mean,
That's what was incredible about the villains in your games, that they were so human. They weren't that cardboard, mwahahaha, if they're bad in one way, they're bad in all ways kind of thing. They all had a heart to them. You know, the brigand leader turns out to be, you know, what a twist on, spoiler, you know, what a twist on the quote-unquote damsel in distress.
Mm-hmm, yes.
That she ends up running the organization. That was very impactful. On me as a young person, where it's sort of like, okay, we have all these, you know, sort of princess in the tower metaphors, but maybe it's not quite so helpless a position. You did that with a lot of your, like, you had warriors who were single mothers, and then you had bad girls that weren't so bad. And the scope of all your types of characters. I mean, you didn't restrict yourself to humans. You had cat people and jackal people and all that stuff. Is that just, did that come sort of naturally to you being a consumer of a lot of fantasy products, or were you making a point with that?
Well, yeah, I was making a point with that. I was trying to break the molds of what was done before, even before there were TV tropes. I could see those tropes were out mm-hmm. there, the damsel in distress and things. And I wanted to consciously, you know, throw the player out of his comfort zone of what he could expect and what he was expecting, anticipating, and suddenly confront him with the fact, oh, this isn't what I thought it would be, you know? And I also wanted to, you know, basically have a world that it would not just be traditional, that, you know, women could be anything they wanted to be, mm-hmm. but I wanted it with context that this was going against tradition. All of my people that were nonconformists were fighting a society.
Mm-hmm.
Quest for Glory 3 had two very different cultures, but mm-hmm. they were all restrictive in different ways.
Yeah, in the way that cultures that are in close proximity to new people tend to be.
Yeah, and so yeah. Quest for Glory 3 was really an outlier. It wasn't supposed to be in the series, but once I thought about it, I said, yes, I really wanted to write this story because it was about a fish out of water, a player being put into a culture of several cultures of the Tarna, the Kenya style area of Africa, which was totally unfamiliar to the player. You know, he didn't know what to expect. He had no support system there. He had a few friends, but he was confronting what it's like to go into a totally new environment of culture, not just a black and white story.
Yeah, I mean, there's a shining, like the character of Uhura, like obviously the Star Trek character, people are like, oh, I know what this is. There's the familiar. But then, you know, you spar with her and her baby is on the floor going, yay, mommy beat up another guy. And, you know, there's the twist on expectations. And then you go and see her culture and all of a sudden the hero's the foreigner, not her. It was a really, really interesting evolution to me in a way you didn't see very many places before. People of color were guests in media in the 90s. We were just starting to get the normalization through shows like, you know, In Living Color and stuff like that, of black people as, you know, the culture. And, you know, obviously you put in the, you know, a nod to one of the pioneer shows in that regard, Sanford and Son in Quest for Glory 3. Were you trying to do that? Were you trying to make a statement in that regard? Or was it just, this is a cool scenario, nobody's done it, let's go?
I was trying it, you know, certainly with the setting of doing that. But, you know, Sanford and Son was because it was a very funny show. Even if it was pretty, you know, its humor was a little cruel, but they were very funny. And it fit. It really fit with the environment. And I really was trying to do, you know, a tribute to that, you know, the actors that performed in it, for one thing, and to the memories that this was a part of our past, and immortalize it in our game, if nothing else, because it was old news at that time. It had been off the air for 10 years at least. You know, this is really appropriate for this area to have, and I needed characters to do this anyway. It was, you know, it was just synergy of what I needed, what was useful, and who I could pull from, you know.
Now, you're having the same phenomenon with your games now. People are making homage games. I mean, obviously, the most obvious one was Quest for Infamy, where you earn infamy points instead of glory points, and you act like a jerk. What's that experience like to have people homaging your games? You know, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery.
Well, it is flattering. It is, you know, keeping the concept alive. But in a sense, the problem with it is when they do not have the same purpose as we're creating games. You know, the idea that the player is a hero, Quest for Infamy kind of undermines it. Yes, it's funny, but it's not the same kind of message. It isn't really this, you know, a Quest for Glory game at all. It's just using that as a medium for telling a different story.
And yet there were still things I think got in there, perhaps by accident, you know, the fact that they have a character who uses a wheelchair, the fact that they have more complex female characters. It's almost like you guys created a DNA for storytelling, that even when people try to go another direction, they can't totally devolve into cynicism.
And that's good, because who wants to be a cynic? We have enough cynicism in the world as it is. We have reasons to be cynics, but it isn't a good place to be. It's not a happy thought. You know, I'm not a Pollyanna, or, well, I kind of am in a lot of ways, but, you know, it's the world does not, can be cruel, it can be frightening, it can be a horrible place to live, but there are moments of beauty. There are things to look at that aren't just the horrors of what can happen, and we need to be reminded constantly that life is worth living, that there are joys. And even the worst of it, you know, there's a pleasure to life that needs to be experienced.
Make sure you listen to the next two episodes of the Level With Her podcast for more with video game veteran Lori Cole. and become a monthly supporter of the FU Network's groundbreaking programming by going to patreon.com/FUNetworkTV.